Willkommen zum Podcast Global Melange. Hier behandle ich eine Melange aus Zukunft, Technologie, Gesellschaft, Kultur, Kunst, Kreativität und anderen Themen, die ich spannend finde. Ich heiße Marie Herger, stamme aus Wien, lebe aber seit 2001 in der San Francisco Bay Area, dem Silicon Valley. Dort forsche ich nach Technologietrends und schreibe dazu Bücher. Dabei fasziniert mich die Überschneidung und die gegenseitige Beeinflussung, die Technologien, Verhaltensweisen, Kunst, Kultur, Politik oder Gesellschaft aufeinander haben. Dazu lade ich interessante Persönlichkeiten aus unterschiedlichen Disziplinen ins Kaffeehaus ein und dort philosophieren wir dann bei einer Melange oder einem Mokka über verschiedene Fragen der Menschheit. Ich hoffe, du findest diese Themen genauso faszinierend wie ich. Die Podcasts und Blogs sowie weitere Links sind auf der Website globalmelange.com verfügbar. So today I have Carrie Love on the podcast, Global Melange. We had a little break in between. We had not longer made for some longer time some recordings. But now I have Carrie Love, who lives in Southern California and originates from Austria, or to be more precisely from Braunau. And he had quite an interesting life that we want to talk today about. Hi, Carrie.
Good morning.
Carrie, the first question is, so you were born in Austria to an Austrian family, so to speak. Yeah, your father was from Vienna. Your mother is Austrian. But you have an American name, Carrie. How does it get to that?
My mother was very enamored of the actor Cary Grant. And so I was named after him.
Yeah, so, I mean, he was a handsome guy, yeah? And you know, there were some really great movies that he made. I mean, all these screwball comedies and charades, yeah? I've seen all of them, so I can understand your mom choosing that name. But let's go to that. You were born in Austria after the war to a Viennese father, and your mother was from where was she, actually?
Yeah, so the circumstances of my being born there were that, and in Braunau in particular, were that due to my father's work. My father was an Austrian national, Jewish, who had just escaped just before the war, went back after the war and worked on the Nuremberg military war crimes tribunals. And after that, was hired by U.S. Army counterintelligence in the post-war occupation of Austria. And the place where he was assigned happened to be in Braunau. And I think the only reason that they established a facility there was because of the symbolism of it being Adolf Hitler's birthplace. My parents were living, had recently moved to Braunau at the time that I was born. And we lived there for several years before moving to Linz and nearby, and then later to Germany.
Mm-hmm. But your father was Jewish, you said. How did he?
Both my parents, both, right. My mother was actually from Slovakia, what is now Slovakia. And she survived the war in hiding in Slovakia and then later immigrated and met my father in the United States before they went back to Europe.
Mm-hmm. And your father, he could escape to the U.S. I understood he was basically coming back as a military, with the military to Europe.
Right. He was in the military during the war. He actually was in the United States Army during the war, but now he was no longer in the military. He was in a civilian capacity working for the military in the post-war occupation.
What I also understood, because I read your biography, Becoming American, an interesting read, and a lot of stuff happening there. I think many people during that period really had similar many experiences like that, especially of of course, if you're of Jewish origin. Your name, while it is an Americanized name, Carrie Loew, it's actually originally Loewy, as understood, also having something to do with the gentleman, the rabbi, who invented something that we all know if you look a little bit into history, correct?
On my father's side, far back, several centuries back, it's believed in the family that we are descended from the famous rabbi Judah Loew of Prague, who is was a real person, but in Jewish mythology, I'll say, or folklore, he created this creature called the golem from inanimate matter. And eventually, because he lost control of it, had to destroy it, and it was put away there in one of the temples in Prague. But Rabbi Loew's crypt in the old Jewish cemetery in Prague is now a very famous tourist visiting site. As I described my book, my daughter had quite a mystical experience there at the tomb. That's an interesting bit of family lore, I'll call it. No way to be absolutely certain about it, but it was always my father's understanding that that connection was there.
Well, it's basically, today we would say Rabbi Loew was a robot builder, basically. He built a robot. Inanimate matter.
Supposedly, and this is one version of the story, that the author Mary Shelley patterned her character Frankenstein after the golem.
Yeah. No, the reason why I like this such stories is because the fears and the intentions that we have in building such things, and these stories are coming up 2,500 years ago the first time as well, are basically reflections of human fears and and often used for moral and ethical stories, how to react, because these animals or these animas and these beings tend to not have common sense. That's why he had to destroy it. Sometimes we may have the feeling that humans also don't have this common sense. But let's continue a little bit, because Braunau is one place that you stayed. You were then also in Linz for some time, and then you moved to Germany because of your father's.
Right. His work was transferred first to Linz, where we at an American military base there. And then when the occupation ended in Austria in 1955, he changed jobs to work for a different military intelligence agency at U.S. Air Force headquarters in Europe in Wiesbaden, Germany. So we moved to Wiesbaden and were there, and also one other place in Germany, but for the next half dozen years. And then in the early 1960s, we finally moved to the United States for the first time.
Yeah. Before we move to the United States, I wanted to ask you, did you have a time to talk to your father about the Nuremberg trials? Mm-hmm. How he felt about that?
Yeah, it was probably more difficult for my mother than for my father, because my mother had lost her entire family, well, except for one sister, in the war, and many other relatives, and had been in hiding. And so, her views about Germany and the Nazis was even more profound than my father's. But my father also had lost relatives, not immediate family, but other relatives. So I think that from what he talked about later, it gave him a certain sense of satisfaction, vindication, that he had survived, that my mother had survived, and that now they were in a position to exact a certain measure of justice, mm-hmm. And be involved in that process. This was a very unique situation. There had never been war crimes trials before. No other country had ever done this before after a war. And I think it was just the magnitude of what the Nazis had done that made it so important to do that in this case. And I know he always felt very proud of his involvement there, and also, as I said, some sense of not vengeance, but satisfaction of having held some of these people accountable. But on the other hand, there was a feeling of frustration and regret, because, as you probably know, the trials were brought to a halt very suddenly. There were a lot of potential defendants who were never brought to trial because the trials became very unpopular with the German populace. And at that time, the United States and the other wartime allies were more concerned with getting support for their side in the Cold War against the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And so stopping the trials was one way of building a more favorable rapport with the German people in the mm-hmm. post-war era. So, you know, I think there was always some frustration there that the trials didn't go on further and bring more of those defendants to account.
I mean, at least others took over, like Simon Wiesenthal, who looked for criminals, war criminals that had escaped, or the Israelis themselves, they were hunting them down, as we've seen. So the worst offenders could not hide. That was basically my understanding then, even that they stopped. And even if I don't agree with that they stopped it, because it just gave too many people an excuse to just, go on and keep their ideology. And that's what we basically see today in Austria and in Germany with the success of the right-wing parties again, coming up there. So it was maybe too early. So tell me also, how was it as a life, the life that as a young boy in post-war Austria and Germany that you had experienced? My understanding also was that due to the work of your father, you had some privileges that made it easier.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, that was one real benefit of my father's work, was that because he was working for the occupation forces, we had access to all of the facilities and privileges, of the occupiers, and we're not like the, so we could shop at the American military stores. We had a car and a driver assigned to us. Nobody had private automobiles at that point, so the military provided us with one. They provided us with housing, health care, everything, just as if we were part of the military. So I had, a somewhat privileged childhood in that respect compared to the Austrian kids that were around me. But at the same time, I interacted very freely with them, because we lived in a neighborhood of Braunau where called Ranshofen, where most of the residents were local Austrians. There were just a handful of the families that were associated with my father's work. I had an Austrian nanny as a child. I spoke German as my first language, so I interacted very easily with people there in Braunau and then in Linz and later in Germany. So that so it was kind of a hybrid experience, on the one hand, feeling like I was part of the community, but on the other hand, again, having a lifestyle that was a little more privileged than most of the people around me.
And when you moved to the US, was this something that you wanted? Was it the family was ready to go, or would you have rather preferred to stay in Europe at this time? What was your feeling, idea?
My parents decided at some point that it was simply time for me and my brother to become more Americanized. even though we were by that time living entirely around American families, attending American schools. Now, this was in Wiesbaden, which was a huge American military complex there. Most of the time, not always, but most of the time, we lived in a housing area with other American families, and I attended schools there and so on, as did my brother, who is 3 years younger than me. But my parents still felt like if our future was in the United States, we needed to become more Americanized. And
can I interrupt you? What is your understanding of being Americanized?
Well, I'm not quite sure what they thought. I think it was just that they felt like I should be more immersed in American society and culture than I would be living in Europe, even surrounded by other Americans. And I look back on it, I don't know that that was really necessary. Frankly, I would have been very happy to have stayed in Europe longer. But a high-ranking military officer that my father worked with, an Air Force colonel, was transferred to a base in the Boston area, and he knew that my parents were interested in moving to the United States, so he arranged it for my father to rejoin him there at this air base outside Boston. So that opportunity appeared very quickly, and my parents had to decide very immediately whether they would do it or not, and they did. So we packed up and moved to this town of Bedford, Massachusetts, outside Boston, which is where I then went to high school before later moving to California.
Well, so what was the most different then when you arrived and really made the move? Not just being on a visit there like you have done before, but being then there embedded in the school system in the American world.
It took some adjusting because now everybody I dealt with spoke exclusively English. And the culture around me was completely American, whereas previously, yes, I was surrounded by Americans, but outside that, I was surrounded by Germans. So it was in Europe. I had a very mixed, hybrid cultural experience. Now I had a very exclusively American experience, and that was impressed on me even more because where we were living was right in the middle of the colonial history of the United States. The town we lived in was right between Lexington and Concord, the towns where the first battles of the American Revolution took place. Boston, the whole Boston area is filled with those kinds of historical sites, and we visited all of them soon after moving there. So I was just thrust right into the middle of all of this American history. Whereas previously I had been much more exposed to European history. We traveled all over Europe and visited all kinds of historical and cultural sites. Now that was kind of behind us, and we were instead immersing ourselves completely in American history and culture, which didn't mean that we had to forget the European experience. Mm-hmm. At home, we were still very European oriented culturally in terms of the music my parents played, the books that were in our home. We stayed in touch with people in Europe. So we didn't put all of that experience behind us, but on a day-to-day basis, yeah, it was very different, and it took me a little while to adjust.
My understanding was also that you joined the Navy then.
You know, I had lived around the Army and the Air Force, so it's a good question, why the Navy? It actually started when we were still in Europe, because I used to watch this television program on the Armed Forces television network about American Naval Academy midshipmen. And then there was a small naval base on the Rhine River near Wiesbaden. I remember going there and seeing the boats and meeting sailors. So I got this idea that I wanted to actually make a career of the Navy. And I had an opportunity to, I qualified for a scholarship, a college scholarship offered by the Navy, that they would put me through college if I would then serve for at least 4 years as an officer in the Navy. And so they put me through both my undergraduate and my master's degree. And then I was commissioned as an officer in the Navy, went on active duty. Mm-hmm. And I would have served, I might have made a career of it, but although by that time I was already changing my mind about that, but I would have served for at least 4 or 5 years, except that I got injured and was discharged early from the Navy for medical reasons. So that was the end of my naval career.
What was it that you studied? What was the college that you visited?
Well, I actually had a very varied educational experience. I started out as an English literature major, thinking I might be a writer or a journalist. And that's years later, actually, that's what I became. But I then went to graduate school in international relations. That was my father's influence from his intelligence work. And I focused particularly on the Middle East, which was something he had focused on in his work. Then I went in the Navy. But when I came out, I went to law school, thinking that I might work in international law. But again, I changed direction while I was in law school and became much more interested in domestic legal and policy issues. Came out of law school and worked in politics for several years before assuming a more normal legal career, and essentially worked as a real estate and environmental lawyer for 40 years. But early in that period, I also went back to graduate school and got a PhD in urban planning. So that really supported my work in the land use and environmental areas of law. Turned out to be very useful. And later on, I married a woman who had an environmental consulting firm, and so I also did work with her company and her staff on planning and environmental issues.
I mean, listening to you, and on the other side, having read your biography, yeah, you make it sound like, oh, it's nothing about it, it's just doing it like this. Yeah, but you're basically, when you say you were thinking of doing international relations in law, but then turned into something more domestic. You helped actually a lot of tenants to not get price hikes, rent price hikes from landlords, and avoid people getting evicted. And it's not just that you had a few cases. You basically laid the foundation that landlords cannot abuse the system, and worked with the governor, with Jerry Brown, who was a several times.
Yeah, I had some great opportunities to work with government officials. Through my early political work, I had been connected to a lot of people, like you mentioned, Governor Jerry Brown back in the 1970s. Later, in Los Angeles, the city council, same in San Diego. When I moved here, I became involved in local politics here and served on quite a few advisory commissions to different government agencies. And to me, that was all a really important part of what I called my Americanization, you know, to become so integrated into and involved with not just the culture, but public institutions and policy making and all of that.
I think this is something that makes a huge difference in the US and in Europe. In the US, I have the feeling that it's really a civil society where people engage much, much more in public things than they do in Europe, where you expect more that the government or state is doing that. Did you ever consider running for an office?
I did one time. In Los Angeles, I explored running for the Los Angeles City Council, which would have been a lot easier in those days than it would be today. But I realized that two things, that one, it required raising a lot of money, more than I thought I could do. Mm-hmm. And I also decided in talking with my wife at the time that we didn't really want to live in the kind of fishbowl that being a public official requires. And a good friend of mine wanted to run for the same city council seat, so I backed off and helped him instead, and he was elected. Not the first time, but he ran a second time and was elected. So I was happy to give up that and instead to be more of an advisor and behind-the-scenes person rather than being an elected official. I never had any regrets about that choice.
I think running as a politician or being a politician is actually really a tough thing. And as I said, I would see the same. So I admire everyone who's running. I give them the benefit of the doubt that most of the politicians that I've met are really trying to make improvements for their citizens, for their people. Yeah. And that nobody's going in there for the power greed, because it's just not possible from the beginning. Yeah? You have to really work very hard to get there. But let's come back to real estate and a very special type of real estate. And that's not in Los Angeles. It's not in California, but that's in Austria, namely the birthhouse of Hitler in Braunau. Somehow you got involved with that. Those of you who don't know the Hitler's birth, there's the birthhouse of Hitler in Braunau. He was born Austrian. And this has been a pain in the neck for a long time in Austria. And there is, first they tried, it was a privately still owned property, became a piece where the Nazis were always commemorating Hitler's birthday or whatever. And now they're using, and now it's a part of the state. So the state owns it now has ideas or does not have ideas what to do with that. And somehow you got involved with that. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, well, the apartment house where Adolf Hitler was born there in Braunau was owned by a local family for many, many years. And as you say, it was a place where neo-Nazis sometimes rallied, especially on Hitler's birthday. The local town government put a monument in front of the house, a memorial to the victims of the Holocaust. And that helped deter those kinds of things. But still, the federal government in Austria wanted to acquire the property and turn it into something neutral. And they did manage to acquire it just a few years ago. But then that opened the question of what to do with it. And the government's decision was to turn it into a police station, which a lot of people thought was a very bad symbolism. I got involved with this because an Austrian planner who I met when he was working here in San Diego introduced me to a fellow named Andreas Meislinger, who is well known in Austria as the founder of the Austrian I'd say the equivalent of the Peace Corps that sends young Austrian people to work on projects all over the world, but especially ones associated with the Holocaust. And Meislinger was had an idea to convert the what they called the Hitler House into a what he called a house of responsibility that would be a study center, conference center, to educate people about fascism and promote pacifism and so on. And he worked, he asked me to join with him in that because of my background in Braunau, but also being a lawyer and educator and taught in universities. And he just thought that my overall credentials would lend additional weight to his efforts, but especially because I was originally from Braunau. So we worked on that for a couple of years. The government made a decision that they would go ahead with the police station conversion, and but they haven't actually started working on that yet. So I don't know. There may still be an opportunity to take it in the direction that Mr. Meislinger had in mind. But at the moment, it appears that they are going to do the police station conversion, which, again, I disagree with, but their belief is that that would completely deter the neo-Nazis from rallying there because they wouldn't do that in front of a police station.
We've spoken before about that, we both agree somehow the police station is probably not the best use case for that. I think even the police doesn't want it, right?
That's my understanding, that nobody is really that supportive of the idea. The local people are not supportive of it. But that's the Austrian Minister of the Interior makes the decision.
Well, maybe with a new government where we do not have really like a police style chancellor governing who has just this kind of ideas, maybe we will have more visions of what we can do with that station, with that house. Carrie, I think it was a great, interesting story of an Austrian. Just let me ask you the last question. How is your German?
Not good.
It is something that you easily forget, especially when you're getting too Americanized, I guess. You don't have a strong accent like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
No. I started speaking English at a very early age, even though German was my first language. I started speaking English before I ever started school. So by the when we moved from Braunau to Linz, then I had to speak English every day. In Braunau, I could get away with German most of the time. But in Linz, I was now going to American schools. I had to improve my English immediately. So, and I was in school with Americans who had all kinds of accents because they came from many different parts of the United States. You know, New Englanders, Southerners, New Yorkers, people with all kinds of different accents. So I think I just blended all of those together and wound up with very little, if any, accent. Although my wife jokes with me that I often say very German things, like I'll answer her instead of saying yes, I'll say ja. You know, just little things that are remnants of my German speaking.
That happens to the best of us. Thank you so much, Carrie, for your insights and for the stories that are more relevant than ever, I think, unfortunately. And given the thing that we have another war at the moment, not far from where you had lived, I mean, a few hundred miles, but still, and we probably need to have another kind of Nuremberg trial now for somebody else, is showing out how important it is, and that democracy, like the American way, yeah, and that we are doing as well is very important. Thank you so much, Kerry, for your time.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be with you. And if I may, just as a closing comment, remind you that I have a memoir that I've published of my experiences entitled Becoming American.
I will link it in the show notes.
Seinem Leben wissen will, ich habe seine Biografie Becoming American und einen Link zu seiner Website hier hinter den Shownotes hinterlegt. Ich hoffe, es hat dir gefallen und wir hören uns das nächste Mal wieder.